The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to welcome all of you here this evening. It's a good crowd. One of the weird reasons I have this job is because of my powers of clairvoyance. Yes, I knew that Viet Thanh Nguyen was going to receive the Pulitzer for fiction yesterday, which is why I booked him for tonight last July. It's such a mic drop moment that I don't need to say much else. You'll find more details in your program. However, I want to point you toward his website, viettanhnguyen.info, where he offers an eloquent description of what it means to receive the Pulitzer, and where he explains that he is utterly aware that he stands on the shoulders of all of those who came before him. It is a humbling piece to read. Nguyen is a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, and he runs the blog Diacritics, which is devoted to the arts, culture, and politics of Vietnamese and Vietnamese Americans. Please welcome Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. This has literally never happened to me. Thank you. Don't stop. No, of course you should. Thanks, Andy, for having me. It was a real honor to be invited here. And it really just struck me now as I was standing backstage that this is Pennsylvania. You know, I'm an American. I have terrible geography. It's like, oh, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But the interesting thing about this is that when I first came as a refugee to the United States, it was to Pennsylvania. It was to Fort Indiantown Gap, which was one of four refugee camps set up in 1975 to absorb the 150,000 or so Vietnamese refugees that were fleeing from the fall of Saigon or the fall of South Vietnam. And I begin that with this story because I think it's important to claim that I'm a refugee and not an immigrant. So in so many ways, when I've been discussed and my story has been discussed, my books have been discussed, is to frame it as an immigrant success story or a story about, you know, the immigrant experience and so on. And it certainly is that, both my story and my parents' story, but first and foremost, a refugee experience. And refugees are fundamentally different than immigrants, which is why today I think we're seeing so much fear of refugees all over the world. And of course, as a refugee, I don't think we should be afraid of refugees. I think I turned out okay. So did many other refugees I turned out. Some of them didn't turn out so well, but you know, that's humanity. There's many citizens who didn't turn out so well either. What I'm going to do tonight is talk to you about two books, The Sympathizer and Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, which just came out like a week or two ago. And I think of them as the fictional and the non-fictional bookends of a lifelong project to think about what war and memory means, specifically for me, the Vietnam War, but in a much broader sense, war and how we remember, how we forget. And I think it began for me with coming to Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. I was 4 years old, and the first narrative memory that I have, the first like story that I could tell, was being taken away from my parents and being sent to live with a white family. Because in order to leave a refugee camp, you had to have a sponsor. And no sponsor would take my entire family of four. So my 10-year-old brother went to one family, my parents went to another, and I went to another, which for only a few months, but when you're 4 years old, that really felt like forever. And it's remained an invisible brand stamped between my shoulder blades and has influenced my life, and I've tried to make sense of that. So one of the things that I did was I wrote a novel called The Sympathizer, which is about a communist spy in the South Vietnamese army in April 1975 as Saigon is about to fall or to be liberated, depending on your point of view. And because he's a communist spy, he sees both sides of that. And he flees to the United States, and his job is to spy on the efforts of the remnants of the South Vietnamese army as they try to take their country back. So there's a lot of politics, intrigue, and violence, and all of this kind of good stuff. But there's also some humor. So one of the things that happens to him is that he becomes, in California, the authenticity consultant on the making of an epic Vietnam War movie to be shot in the Philippines that is conjured completely out of my imagination. Okay. So in this scene, he's going to discuss his meeting with the famous director, who is known only as the auteur, and two other characters will appear, the general, his boss, and the madam, the general's wife. After I descended from the auteur's home to the general's, I reported my first experience with the motion picture industry to the general and madam, both of whom were infuriated on my behalf. My meeting with the auteur had gone on for a while longer, mostly in a more subdued fashion, with me pointing out that the lack of speaking parts for Vietnamese people in a movie set in Vietnam might be interpreted as cultural insensitivity. "Do you not think it would be a little more believable," I said, "a little more realistic, a little more authentic, for a movie set in a certain country, for the people in that country to have something to say instead of having your screenplay direct, as it does now, cut to villagers speaking in their own language? Do you think it might not be decent to let them actually say something, instead of simply acknowledging that there is some kind of sound coming from their mouths? Could you not even just have them speak a heavily accented English, just to pretend that they're speaking in an Asian language that somehow American audiences can strangely understand? You know what I mean, Ching Chong English." The auteur grimaced and said, "Very interesting, great stuff, loved it. But I had a question. What was it?" "Oh, yes. How many movies have you made?" "None. Isn't that right? None? Zero? Zilch? Nada? Nothing? And however you say it in your language? So thank you for telling me how to do my job. Now get the hell out of my house and come back after you've made a movie or two. Maybe then I'll listen to one or two of your cheap ideas." "Why was he so rude?" Madam said. "Didn't he ask you to give him some comments?" "He was looking for a yes man. He thought I'd give him a rubber stamp of approval. He thought you were going to fawn over him. When I didn't do it, he was hurt. He's an artist. He's got thin skin." "So much for your career in Hollywood," the general said. "I don't want a career in Hollywood," I said, which was true only to the extent that Hollywood did not want me. I confess to being angry with the auteur, but was I wrong in being angry? This was especially the case when he acknowledged he did not even know that Montagnard was simply a French catch-all term for the dozens of Highland minorities. "What if," I said to him, "I wrote a screenplay about the American West and simply called all the natives Indians? You'd want to know whether the cavalry was fighting the Navajo or Apache or Comanche, right? Likewise, I would want to know, when you say these people are Montagnards, whether we speak of the Bru or the Nung or the Tay." "Let me tell you a secret," the auteur said. "You ready? Here it is. No one gives a shit." He was amused by my wordlessness. To see me without words is like seeing one of those Egyptian felines without hair, a rare and not necessarily desirable occasion. How could I be so dense? How could I be so deluded? I naively believed that I could divert the Hollywood organism from its goal, the simultaneous lobotomization and pickpocketing of the world's audiences. Hollywood did not just make horror movie monsters. It was its own horror movie monster, smashing me under its foot. I had failed, and the auteur would make the Hamlet as he intended, with my countrymen serving merely as raw material for an epic about white men saving good yellow people from bad yellow people. I pitied the French for their naivete in believing they had to visit a country in order to exploit it. Hollywood was much more efficient, imagining the countries it wanted to exploit. I was maddened by my helplessness before the auteur's imagination and machinations. His arrogance marked something new in the world, for this was the first war where the losers would write history instead of the victors, courtesy of the most efficient propaganda machine ever created, with all due respect to Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis who never achieved global domination. Hollywood's high priests understood innately the observation of Milton's Satan, that it was better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, better to be villain, loser, or antihero than virtuous extra, so long as one commanded the bright lights of center stage. In this forthcoming Hollywood trompe-l'oeil, all the Vietnamese of any side would come out poorly, herded into the roles of the poor, the innocent, the evil, or the corrupt. Our fate was not to be merely mute. We were to be struck dumb. So the novel will go on to deal with a lot of intrigue and action and things like that. But the last thing that I'll read from the novel is about another part of the Vietnamese refugee life, which many people don't know about, which is that, you know, the Vietnamese refugees that I knew growing up, although they were steeped in melancholy and sadness and bitterness and rage for having lost their country and lost a war, were also people who loved to drink and sing and dance and smoke. And so one of the first things that they did after arriving in California in Los Angeles was to open a nightclub. And this is true. And then this nightclub would become the basis for something called Paris by Night, which is a song and dance extravaganza. Now in about 120 episodes, filmed in exotic locales from Las Vegas to Paris. And throughout the 1980s and 1990s, this was the primary form of entertainment for people in Vietnam because the production was so much better here in the United States or in the diaspora. So this is the story that leads to that gigantic, spectacular production. And here our narrator encounters a singer who is the forbidden fruit, the general's daughter. Now known by just one name, like John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Mary, Lana stepped on stage, clad in a red velvet bustier, a leopard print miniskirt, black lace gloves, and thigh-high leather boots with stiletto heels. My heart would have paused at the boots, the heels, or the flat, smooth slice of her belly, naked in between miniskirt and bustier. But the combination of all three arrested my heart altogether and beat it with the vigor of a Los Angeles police squad. It's not so funny in Los Angeles where that really happens. Pouring cognac over my heart freed it, but thus drenched it was easily flambéed by her torch song. She turned on the heat with her first number, the unexpected I'd Love You to Want Me, which I had heard before sung only by men. I'd Love You to Want Me was the theme song of the bachelors and unhappily married males of my generation, whether in the English original or the equally superb French and Vietnamese renditions. What the song expressed so perfectly, from lyric to melody, was unrequited love. And we men of the South love nothing more than unrequited love. Cracked hearts are primary weakness after cigarettes, coffee, and cognac. Listening to Lana sing, all I wanted was to immolate myself in a night with her to remember forever and ever. Every man in the room shared my emotion as we watched her do no more than sway at the microphone, her voice enough to move the audience, or rather, to still us. Nobody talked, and nobody stirred, except to raise a cigarette or a glass, an utter concentration not broken for her next, slightly more upbeat number, Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down. Lana's version of Bang Bang layered English with French and Vietnamese. The last line of the French version echoed Phạm Duy's Vietnamese version, We Will Never Forget. In the pantheon of classic pop songs from Saigon, this tricolor rendition was one of the most memorable, masterfully weaving together love and violence in the enigmatic story of two lovers who, regardless of having known each other since childhood, or because of knowing each other since childhood, shoot each other down. Bang Bang was the sound of memory's pistol firing into our heads. For we cannot forget love. We cannot forget war. We cannot forget lovers. We cannot forget enemies. We cannot forget home. And we cannot forget Saigon. We cannot forget the caramel flavor of iced coffee with coarse sugar, the bowls of noodle soup eaten while squatting on the sidewalk, the strumming of a friend's guitar while we swayed on hammocks under coconut trees, the whisper of a dewy lover saying the most seductive words in our language, Anoy. The working men who slept in their siklos on the streets, kept warm only by the memories of their families, the refugees who slept on every sidewalk of every city, the sweetness and firmness of a mango plucked fresh from its tree, the girls who refused to talk to us and who we only pine for more, the men who had died or disappeared, the streets and homes blown away by bombshells, the streams where we swam naked and laughing, the secret grove where we spied on the nymphs who bathed and splashed with the innocence of the birds, the shadows cast by candlelight on the walls of wattled huts, the barking of a hungry dog in an abandoned village, the appetizing reek of the fresh durian one wept to eat, the sight and sound of orphans howling by the dead bodies of their mothers and fathers, the stickiness of one's shirt by afternoon, the stickiness of one's lover by the end of lovemaking, and the stickiness of our situations. And while the list could go on and on and on, the point was simply this. The most important thing we could never forget was that we could never forget. So that's been true of me and of many Vietnamese people I know. Thank you. That has also never happened to me before, so thank you very much. I should have recorded this. So I had a lot to say in the novel, and then at the end I realized, oh, I have more to say. So I wrote another book, Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War. And, you know, it started off as a very narrow academic project in 2002, which is really scary to say, which means it took about 13 years. And it's an investigation of how we remember this war, which, you know, in the United States and in Vietnam is remembered as a conflict between Americans and Vietnamese. And I wanted to go beyond that because I think that's actually a false dichotomy. Leads us in the wrong direction if we think of the war in that way. So the war also investigates how Cambodia has remembered this, Laos has remembered this, South Korea, and Southeast Asian diasporas in the United States. And it ended up becoming a nonfiction cultural history in which I invested everything that I had learned as a novelist, everything about narrative, about rhythm, about emotion, about theme, into the writing of the book and into the prose itself. So I'm not going to dwell on it much longer. I'm just going to read you a paragraph from the prologue of the book, and it'll give you a sense of how it's written and a little insight into the sympathizer. I was born in Vietnam, but made in America. I count myself among those Vietnamese dismayed by America's deeds, but tempted to believe in its words. I also count myself among those Americans who often do not know what to make of Vietnam and want to know what to make of it. Americans, as well as many people the world over, tend to mistake Vietnam with the war named in its honor, or dishonor, as the case may be. This confusion has no doubt led to some of my own uncertainty about what it means to be a man with two countries, as well as the inheritor of two revolutions. Today, the Vietnamese and American revolutions manufacture memories only to absolve the hardening of their arteries. For those of us who consider ourselves to be inheritors of one or both of these revolutions, or who have been influenced by them in some way, we have to know how we make memories and how we forget them so that we can beat their hearts back to life. That is the project, or at least the hope, of this book. Thank you very much. Now comes my favorite part of these events, which is talking with the audience, hearing your questions and your comments. I really enjoy doing that.
I'm just wondering what caused you to want to become an English teacher?
My parents ask exactly the same question. Well, you know what? We're in the library, and some of my earliest memories in Pennsylvania were actually in the Harrisburg Public Library in the bookmobile. And I think that for me, and you know, the library became a second home because even though I couldn't articulate it at the time, I was certainly absorbing the fact that we were refugees and that we were going through very difficult circumstances, financially, emotionally. And you know, at a certain point, my parents became store owners, which meant they lived the stereotypical shopkeeper's life. They worked every day of the week, 12 hours a day, 12 to 14 hours a day, literally. 7 days a week, every day of the year, except Christmas, New Year's, and Easter, because we're devout Catholics, or they are devout Catholics. I'm a horrible Catholic. So the library became my second home, and I think it became a place for me to escape from the realities of refugee life, and I learned to love literature there, and I learned also that there were stories and ideas in the library that were really, really powerful. I mean, there was kids' stories, children's stories that were moving, but because libraries are not boundaried, what is this, a word? They don't have boundaries. You know, as a little kid, I could go anywhere I wanted and read adult fiction. I was reading horrible things that I would never let my own son read, okay? It's really scary, actually. But those experiences made me and gave me the sense that stories could be powerful and transgressive. And that's one of the reasons why I became an English professor. But I also have to add that as an undergraduate at Berkeley, I majored in English and ethnic studies. I never would have become an English professor without ethnic studies, because for me, as a refugee, looking at English, it was fun. You know, I loved reading, but I couldn't, you know, find a way to actually justify it. Couldn't find a way to think studying the Romantics or the Victorians is going to somehow do justice to the world. And that was what I needed to make that connection between literature and justice in order to allow myself the freedom to pursue a PhD. And ethnic studies was what enabled that. And when it was reading Chicano literature, it was reading African American literature, Asian American literature, that convinced me, no, books are not just about words inside a book. These words are connected to the world outside of it. And English professors weren't always making that claim, but ethnic studies professors always were. And that was really my inspiration.
Fellow back here on our right.
Thank you very much for this and obviously for taking the time. But I had a question specifically. It's just really interesting to see this and then coming out with the nonfiction as well. And I've read a little bit about you talking about your short story process and W.G. Sebald and like the kind of fact and fiction blurring. And so I'm really curious to hear about your process from short story to this to the nonfiction and to also maybe where you see it going, even just from the seed of was this a short story that started, and then how they're sort of influencing and blending together now, especially seeing them sort of converge in the way they are.
That's a really traumatic question, because I think for I've been writing here and there throughout my childhood and stuff, and when I got to college, I took some writing workshops and. I made a decision when I had to apply for graduate school. Being, I could not get away from being the stereotypical Asian refugee or immigrant. I looked at my prospects and thought, what is the best graduate school I can possibly get into? And it wasn't going to be a creative writing program. I was not that great of a writer when I was 21, and I knew that. So I applied to go into the PhD program. And I had to compartmentalize my life. You know, I had to be trained to be a scholar on the one side. That was on the forefront, and then also, keep my passions alive as a fiction writer on the sidelines. And I swore to myself, though, that when I got tenure, I would devote myself to writing fiction at least equally, and that's what happened. So I had these starry-eyed ambitions that, I'll get tenure, and then it'll just be easy street. I'm just going to knock off these short stories like this, and then I'm going to be the next hot young thing. And I spent 10 to 15 years in misery writing short stories. And you ask about craft and technique. I had no idea what I was doing. And to this day, writing short stories terrifies me. I thought I'd get sucked back into that quagmire of an aesthetic form I have no understanding of. I can appreciate it. I enjoy reading short stories, but I cannot, for the life of me, make sense of why one technique is better than another technique for me when it comes to writing a short story. So when my agent told me he read the short story collection, he liked it. But he said, you know what, if you want to be published in New York City, you got to write a novel. I said, fine, I'll do that. And lo and behold, it was like I'd been beating my head against the wall for 10 or 15 years. And when I got to the novel, it was like I broke through. And suddenly I had all this freedom. I had the form that I wanted and needed. Maybe I wouldn't have been able to exploit that form without the suffering that I had gone through learning how to write short stories. But regardless, it was enormously liberating, and I wrote the novel in 2 years. The novel is two or three times as long as a short story collection and is written in about a seventh of amount of time. And what happened with that was, you know, when connecting to the nonfiction, if any of you have read academic criticism, the stereotypes about it are oftentimes true, you know, that it's hard to read and all of that. And I spent a decade acquiring that academic language that I needed to, you know, be a professor, and I spent at least a decade forgetting that language through the act of writing fiction. But the interesting thing about writing the novel was that it finally also liberated me from academic writing in the conventional sense. I'd never lost my faith in scholarship. I believe that scholarship is crucial, and that if done right, it can reach a general audience, right? And so I took everything I learned from writing that novel and said, okay, I'm going to write a nonfiction book that is a story from beginning to end, that has feelings that will hopefully carry the reader from beginning to end. I know for me what I wanted to do when I wrote the nonfiction after the incredible experience of writing a novel. It was really 2 years of mostly a wonderful experience, which is very rare. After that, I didn't want to subject myself to writing the horrible writing experience anymore. So I thought, I'm going to write this nonfiction book, and I want to be moved by it. And by moved, I don't mean feeling boredom and stress. I mean moved as in feeling something actually like passion. And that was what happened. I mean, I wrote the nonfiction book in about a year. So I think that, you know, my ambition, I haven't realized it, you know, but my ambition is to write fiction that's like criticism, and criticism that's like fiction. At some point in the future, I hope to finally get there. But there, you know, when you read the novel, there's obviously a lot of critique going on in there. Don't worry, there's something to offend everybody here. So if you feel personally offended by my political critiques, like comparing Hollywood to Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis, and say, that's unjustified, well, I'm sure you'll feel happy about the critiques that are leveled at the Communist Party. You know, so in other words, we have to learn how to accept the critiques that are directed at us as well as the critiques we would love to level at other people. And then the criticism, again, has fictional elements in it as well in terms of storytelling.
So my question is to do more about identity. In The Sympathizer, I think the character has a lot of fluidity with his identity. And I was wondering, is that something you personally have experience with growing up as a refugee, as an Asian, as an Asian American? Like, how does that, have you always thought about this, or is this something that really came to fruition later on in your life?
Well, the first thing is that The Sympathizer is about a narrator who is a liar, a spy, an alcoholic, a womanizer, a traitor, a murderer. Thankfully, it's not autobiographical, you know. But the part that's autobiographical is the one that your question touches on, which is that, you know, as a sympathizer, as a spy who's constantly living a fake life, he's always experiencing his duality, right? That was pretty much me too, except in the novel, I my life is really boring, so in the novel, I just take it to an extreme and render it through the life of a spy. But I think I've talked to many people who are minorities in one way or another. I'm not just talking about racial minorities, but anybody who feels different in some really substantive way. And oftentimes, you know, we feel like we're spies. You know, we feel like we have to don masks, that we live dual existences, depending on the circumstances, our home, whatever that is. And even at home, I don't feel at home. Even at home, you know, with my parents, I don't think they know who I am because I've been often doing all kinds of weird American things for decades and decades, and I'm no longer the person that I was. And in the outside world, in contexts where I'm the only, and this has happened to me often, the only Asian American or the only non-white person in a room, of course I feel like I'm eavesdropping and that I'm spying and that I'm, you know, I'm taking mental notes on everything everybody says. You know, I'm smiling, but I'm taking mental notes. It's all going to go into the novel or a short story or an essay or something, right? And that's both irritating, but also really useful for a writer to try to be able to make sense of that duality of the crisis of identity and not simply to suffer for it, but to turn it around. In my case, I turned it into a novel and into stories and into criticism. But I think for all of those who experience what it means to be having a split self or to be a minority or to be other, there's other ways, of course, that we have to figure out how to take these emotional difficulties, transmute them into something useful in our own lives.
I have a question about the narrator's friends. He had two blood brothers. One was named Man, which could also be an American name. And the other had a name that could have been interpreted as a French name. And I was wondering if there was any significance about that.
Well, one of the things that I did in the novel was that I wanted to make the novel feel as seamless as possible, as universal as possible. And one of the ways that I did that was to strip away names. Because I knew that if I were to put real Vietnamese names in this book with all the diacriticals, these would scratch the eye of the non-Vietnamese reader. They would interrupt the surface of the prose. That's a very tactical decision, and people can disagree with it. There's obviously an argument to be made for scratching the eye and making people stop. But in my case, I didn't want to do that. There was other ways this book was going to make people stop, and I didn't want to do it through the word itself on the page. So I was very deliberate in stripping away names, and then in the very few occasions where there are names, I thought about, well, what kind of a name would still be Vietnamese, but would also be smooth on the eye for a non-Vietnamese person? And so that's why there are no diacriticals, but also I chose names that could have these multilingual connotations. In Vietnamese, man's name is Mutton. And in Vietnamese, Bon's name is Bon, which means four. And in Vietnamese, it's not uncommon to have to be given a number as a name. Because, you know, Vietnamese families of a generation ago had 10 or 12 kids. That was common. You feel for the parents and trying to remember all the names of all these kids. So they put them in sequence. But, of course, they have these other connotations that you talked about, man and Bon, or Bon in French. And that has all kinds of literary connotations as well. So all of that was happening there, too.
First of all, I want to say thank you for the talk. I found it quite relevant to what I've been studying right now in a variety of things. And also, I just wanted to point out that the first part about the movie you quoted was actually really funny, because that's just like Apocalypse Now with the lack of language and also the village people having spears for some odd reason. But there's some parallels out there. But as a Vietnamese American who has been studying like critical refugee studies and just like trying to interact with this particular field, like I just want to know a little bit about your take on like Asian American studies, just kind of shifting it over to the scholarly field. How is that related to your writing process? I know you touched on it a little bit, but maybe some elaboration would be kind of nice.
Well, to the first point, I mean, yes, Apocalypse Now was on my mind. That film scarred me at 10 years old when I watched it on that newfangled device called the VCR. And yes, I want to take revenge on Francis Ford Coppola. Yes, I want to take revenge on Hollywood. I couldn't help myself. It was a lot of fun to write it and hopefully to read it. But, you know, the movie, The Hamlet, is actually a compilation of many, many, many Vietnam War movies. I mean, Apocalypse Now is actually a more intelligent movie than The Hamlet is. But I was thinking about the first draft of Apocalypse Now, which was written by John Milius, who was a much more of a red meat-eating kind of guy than Francis Ford Coppola turned out to be. As for Asian American studies, you know, I was 18 or 19. I transferred to Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And or maybe right before I came to Berkeley, I went into one of the legendary bookstores there. This was about 1989, 1990. And I saw a book, The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. And, you know, that book has been controversial among Asian Americans in the long aftermath, but obviously it's very popular. If you say Asian American literature, this is the one book that most non-Asian Americans will know. And certainly for me, who had grown up in San Jose initially in a multicultural background and then went to high school at a very elite Jesuit all-boys prep school where all the Asian American kids, guys, got into a corner and called themselves the Asian Invasion or the Yellow Peril, those pre-racial consciousness days, it was revelatory to see a book on a shelf written by an Asian American about Asian Americans. That was the start of it. But really, I went to Berkeley and then took classes in Asian American studies. And I will never forget, I was very lucky my first semester to get into Introduction to Asian American Studies by Ronald Takaki, who had just written the first comprehensive Asian American history for a popular audience, Strangers from a Different Shore. And he was an incredible lecturer. And there was like 400 of us in the classroom, and all of us got enraged as we listened to these historical lectures about Asian Americans. And none of us had ever realized what had happened to Asian immigrants in the United States. The kinds of laws, the kinds of exploitation, the kinds of discrimination that had been heaped on Asian immigrants since the middle of the 19th century. That was the beginning. Then I took Asian American literature and so on. And it was becoming an Asian American studies student. I was actually an ethnic studies major, but taking so many of these classes that really began my intellectual transformation. And then, you know, it can get much more complicated. I have some ambivalences about the field and so on, but I probably won't bore the audience with that kind of discussion.
Yeah, I read that that you wrote this book really for the Vietnamese diaspora in the U.S. And so I'd be curious to hear what have been some of the most interesting reactions or most kind of striking reactions you've received from the diaspora to this book.
Well, to be honest, actually, I don't even know if I'm being honest with myself, so I'll be honest about that. I think I've said to myself, I wrote this book for myself. And then there's these concentric circles of audiences that go outside beyond that. There's my wife, this poor suffering wife, who's read every word. And after 20 years, has finally started to see some rewards. My agent, my editor, and so on and so on. And yes, I think I deliberately structured this book as a conversation, not a conversation, as a confession from one Vietnamese person who's a spy to another Vietnamese person who's very unsympathetic. And I did it very deliberately because the temptation, if you're a minority in this country, or any country really, is to write for the majority. And that is the death blow of literature, as far as I'm concerned, because it cripples the literature. It makes it weak because we have to translate. And people from the majority never have to translate. They can always assume that people will understand what they're saying. So I put deliberately into the structure of the book this narrative device that meant that my narrator would never have to explain himself, never have to explain Vietnamese culture to somebody else. The only time he does have to explain, he has to explain American culture to this Vietnamese person, and that's where the opportunity for satire and critique comes into play. Now, what this has meant, I think, is that, yes, if I were to think about a larger audience, I think I am writing first and foremost to people who I think are intimate to me. That would be people who are politically, aesthetically sympathetic, or people who are ethnically like me, like these Vietnamese people. And I think that, you know, the amazing thing about it, I've seen hints of it before yesterday, but, you know, Vietnamese people were taking pride in this book in Vietnam and in the United States. I think they were proud of the fact that a Vietnamese-American writer was successful. We're you know, as a minority community and as a colonized country, a formerly colonized country, we're always interested in success stories that prove to the world that we're more than the stereotype, right? And since just in 24 hours since the prize was announced yesterday, my Facebook feed, my Twitter feed has been inundated with messages from many people, but especially you know, Vietnamese people, I don't know any of these people, saying, we're proud of you, in Vietnam and here in the United States. And so there seems to be hunger, not just for here in the United States, for Vietnamese Americans wanting to have their stories heard and have a representative for them, which I really object to being, and I can elaborate upon that, but in Vietnam too. I think there's a hunger for stories because I think in Vietnam there's not a lot of freedom to tell these kinds of stories. And in this book, I really try to be honest about what this war has meant for Americans and Vietnamese people, which includes being very critical of the Communist Party and the revolution, and that's not really permitted in Vietnam. So there's a whole paucity of stories about that.
I'm very pleased to be here this evening to hear you because I read your book last month, and for me it was a masterpiece. And I also consider myself prescient for having put this date on my calendar months ago. Congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize. My book club read your book, and I thought you might like to know that the area where we had the most discussion and the most questions was about the interrogation.
I thought you were going to say the squid, so thank you.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. So I was wondering if you could comment on the role of the interrogation in your book.
Well, I had an outline for the novel before I wrote it, 2 or 3 page synopsis with an ending that involved a lot of shooting and action and all that kind of Hollywood stuff. And I knew when I did that wasn't the actual ending, but I didn't know what the ending was. And so I wrote the novel. And then about 2/3 of the way through the book, I realized I knew where I had to go. I knew where he had to go, the narrator. And he had to end up in interrogation. I'm sorry, I'm giving away the ending, but it was raised in the question. Because the novel is, yes, it's a spy novel, political novel, historical novel. It's also a novel about a man's interiority and his divisions, his struggle with himself. And so the most important part of the novel was that. And it couldn't be an externalized conclusion. It had to be an internalized conclusion. And, you know, it had to, I felt, be a confrontation between the people who are most invested in this war. Americans think they're the most invested in this war, but it's the Vietnamese who are the most invested in this war of all sides. And so it's a confrontation between Vietnamese and Vietnamese at the end. And, of course, a confrontation internally in this character between his split self, his split beliefs, his split racial heritage. And also, you know, the idea of interrogation, it's a mode of power. It's a way by which power forces you to say what power wants you to say. And I knew that already as a Catholic, you know, which is why I'm no longer a Catholic. And so earlier in the book, there's a whole Q&A structure, the catechism that takes place, which all, you know, Catholics are familiar with, I think. I don't know if they still do this, but they did when I was a Catholic. That Q&A structure then becomes the Q&A structure for the interrogation at the end. And the point is that the communist mode of power, Catholic mode of power, aren't that different from each other. They're both authoritarian modes of power, and so are any other modes of power that model themselves on this kind of top-down, do as I say, there's only one answer to one question kind of model. And that's one of the things that the novel wants to criticize.
This isn't what I was going to initially say, but that must be the understatement of the night, you know, that the Vietnamese had a lot more invested in the war. You know, you need 50 of those walls down in D.C. to get all the Vietnamese names on them. And people have to physically imagine that, but that isn't what I want. I'm so thrilled what you said about the ethnic studies being this opening to literature being something real and valuable. I happen to have been at San Francisco State when there was one of the fights for that, and I throw a year before Berkeley, and I feel very gratified that getting tear gas and whatever might have had some positive consequences. You know Karen Yamashita and her international hotel?
Yeah.
And I just think that's absolutely wonderful in terms of what that era felt like, and the people who laid the groundwork for having a place for you to bloom in this way, and I'm really looking forward to reading both of your books.
Thank you. Actually, you know, when I was at Berkeley in 1990 to 92 as an undergraduate, I transferred in. We knew all about the San Francisco Third World Strike and the Berkeley Third World Strike, and our teachers were from that generation, and they kept promising us the 60s are going to come back again. 60s are going to come back again. Never happened, but we tried, you know, and. I really believed in the cause. I believe in the cause. And I became co-chair of the Asian American Political Alliance at the Berkeley campus, which was named explicitly after your organization, and which had coined the term Asian American in 1968 or so. So yeah, that legacy was very much on our minds, very much in my mind as I wrote this book, because obviously one of the outcomes of that moment of struggle in conjunction with the Vietnam War, right? The anti-war movement, Asian American movement, Black Power movement, all these movements of liberation and radical power, they were all tied together at that time. And one of the outcomes of that was the rise of so-called multiculturalism, the rise of recognition for authors of color of all kinds, and Asian American literature. And so I definitely see this book as fitting in this tradition that Karen Tae Yamashita is a part of Asian American literature, also of third world literature, of protest literature, of the literature of decolonization, the literature of ethnic Americans, all these different categories that you can put on this book. I'm very proud to be a part of all those lineages.
I can't resist asking you about Ralph Ellison in regard to all of this, because the beginning of the novel especially seems like such an incredible homage to Invisible Man. So I'm wondering if you can talk about Ellison and your relationship to African American literature, Du Bois' Double Consciousness. It all seems like such a... just so there and so much a part of what you're doing.
Well, absolutely. I think African-American literature has been really crucial to my life, to my development as a writer and as a thinker. And actually, Nothing Ever Dies, the title of that book, is taken from Beloved. And for very deliberate reasons that, you know, what the idea that slavery is a rememory, which is what Morrison coins and deals with in Beloved, is true for many traumatic events, including wars. I wanted to, you know, gesture at that, but also the entire prologue is built around Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, Beyond Vietnam, which is a speech every American should read instead of only hearing I Have a Dream. But it's too difficult of a speech for most Americans to confront. And part of the reason why is because Martin Luther King Jr. draws on this very deep, radical, but African-American tradition of connecting the domestic to the global and of connecting the protests about inequality within the United States to what's happening outside. And then Du Bois was certainly in that tradition too. So this idea of using double consciousness from Du Bois as something that comments not only on an Asian American identity for someone who's domestically in the United States, but as someone who's also colonized, someone who is half French, half Vietnamese, which my narrator is, and someone who's divided between countries was really important to me, so expanding upon that. And then, of course, you know, Invisible Man, I read that book in African-American literature class at Berkeley, taught by Barbara Christian, who was one of the pioneers of black feminist criticism, and blew my mind. You know, I wrote a long paper on Invisible Man. I read that book very, very closely as a student, and was always amazed at the power of that book. I mean, it was immensely pleasurable, not simply a book that was good for a critic to read, but immensely pleasurable. And then as I came to write my novel, though, I dwelled on thinking about Invisible Man on and off for 20 years, and there was one part about it that I didn't like so much, and that's the ending of the book. So in Invisible Man, the Invisible Man becomes radicalized, becomes affiliated with something that looks like the Communist Party called the Brotherhood, and then he's disillusioned. And then he turns at the end, he crawls into his hole, and then he's about to crawl out of his hole at the end, and he says, it's really an individual kind of hope at the end. The collective revolution has failed, let me turn back to the possibility of the individual. And that's what I did not want to do with my novel, because I knew that if I were to write a novel about communist revolution and its fallout and disillusionment and the failure of revolution, the expected move for me in American literature, in America as a whole, would be to end the novel with renunciation. Revolution is terrible. America is wonderful. Let me buy a McDonald's Big Mac, and I'm going to be happy forever. I don't think that's too much of an exaggeration. And I was not going to do that. So it's very important that at the end, although he has tremendous problems with the Vietnamese Communist Revolution, he does not give up on revolution. He does not turn back to being an individual. And as a matter of fact, the narrative at the end of the book turns away from I say this, I say that, to we for the last few pages. And that's very deliberate, because it's formally going to invoke a collective spirit that Ellison renounces by the end of Invisible Man. And I think one of the reasons why Invisible Man was popular during the 1950s is that it spoke very well both to the rise of civil rights and to Cold War feeling in the United States.
Hello. My name is Phuong An. I am an... I'm here. Yay. I'm a sophomore in journalism major at Temple University. Unlike most of the people here, I am from Vietnam. I am an international student. Yesterday, when the news broke, I was commissioned by my people to come here to speak to
you. By your people?
I'm kidding. You're fine.
I saw you videotaping me earlier, actually. Yeah.
I need to show people. Yeah. But we are... Okay, I'm on behalf of Vietnamese people. We are really proud of you because of the title of the book, actually. Not because we have read the books, but we know that you are you are Vietnamese, and you write this book, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, and it deliver a different viewpoint. But my point is, since I came to the United States to study, I met a lot of Vietnamese American, and somehow the conflict still growing within their families and their belief of what Vietnam looks like. So in Vietnam, we understand the atrocity that we did to the South Vietnamese after the war, and how both peoples and political camps became such a nightmare for so many people. And so we decided to, I don't know, somehow to forgive the South Vietnamese that flee the country. But for the Vietnamese Americans in America nowadays, they still have this anger and the bitterness that they cannot get rid of. And as 30th of April approach, they will change their Facebook avatar into black because they want to commemorate that event as something that ties to their heritage, which is just a small part because we have a longer history than that. So what do you think about that as a Vietnamese American? Do you hate us?
Oh God, no. I don't like Vietnamese weather. I'll be honest about that. You know, it's very humid, very hot. I don't like to sweat. But I've seen this before. You know, I've seen it on my own campus. And basically, the situation is this: the war was not simply a revolutionary war to unify and liberate the country. The war was also a civil war, divisive war. And you look at the American Civil War. We're not done with that yet. We're not, right? I mean, all these questions about race and politics and so on, Donald Trump, Black Lives Matter, these are direct ripples from the Civil War, if you have any historical consciousness at all. So it's very hard to ask people to, I can't believe I'm even sympathizing with the Confederacy in the South, but basically it's very hard to ask people to forget defeat, to forget the loss of a country, which is how Vietnamese refugees, Vietnamese Americans experience it. They experience this war as defeat, humiliation, loss, and they see the ramifications very intimately in their family lives. So it's easier, although not easy, for the victorious to forgive and forget, because you have the country, you have everything. And Vietnamese Americans of the second generation, they don't know anything possibly about their history, about Vietnam. What they do know is that they see their parents suffer. And you know, as a Vietnamese person in Vietnam, filial piety, really important. So how are you supposed to reconcile any intellectual understanding, if you have it, of the past with the idea that you owe your parents? And your parents say, this is a war that you can't forget. This is a past you can't forget. That's the situation they find themselves in. I'm not saying that I understand. I'm not saying I agree with the Black April movement and so on, but I understand where the emotions come from. And this whole idea that the Vietnamese have really, in Vietnam, have really understood the past, I doubt that. I do. I mean, I haven't seen that very often. For example, I took Vietnamese classes in Ho Chi Minh City at the National University, and one of my instructors was a Communist Party member. I don't have a problem with that. But we talked about the re-education camps, and she said, you know, that was justified. If we didn't put these people in re-education camps, they would have conducted war against us. I don't think that's an uncommon opinion. Or I had breakfast with the former ambassador to the EU, who was a former National Liberation Front operative, a very intelligent woman. And we talked about refugees, boat people, so-called boat people. And she said those people were not political refugees, in her opinion. They were economic refugees. And every single boat person who's ever made it overseas would tell you, no, we are political refugees. So there's some kind of disjuncture between how you may feel about it and how many people of your generation may feel about it, and how Vietnamese Americans perceive it, and how the state, the Communist Party in Vietnam, perceives it. So yes, the Communist Party is willing to acknowledge a little bit some of these issues, but I don't think there's full reconciliation, forgiveness operating throughout Vietnam. Thank you.
Viet Tan Nguyen. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.